W.
I'll hold it, if you don't mind. Can I?
I'm Bob Masters, being interviewed by Dr. David Stafford. According to the data on the first part of the tape. So I guess we start at the joining up. I joined on the 3rd of November, 1941. I'd been living in Seattle up until that time, but the Americans weren't in the war, so I thought, well, I went up to work at the Boeing plant at Sea Island at the airport there, where there was an elementary flying training school using Tiger Moths. Well, watching them fly off the field was more than I could stand, so I forgot my pass one day, and instead of going back to work when I got it, I went down and joined. I joined as a, in those days it was a pilot or observer, and when you went to ITS, your initial training school, the decision was made from the results of your work, so they said, whether you were super great at math, and that might put you into an observer's seat, but what it was in effect was the basic training for both trades were so parallel that they just took people, they're a little short of pilots this week, well, you're a pilot, and if they're short of navigators, you're, or observers, you're an observer. In my case, they got my records mixed up, and when I got to the Manning Depot in Edmonton, it turned out that they had me listed as a WAG, a wireless operator gunner. And my objections to this started immediately and carried on until the day I was shot down. But each time they'd say, well, next station you can remuster. But right now we're a bit busy. So being young and green, I went along with this instead of sticking my heels in and saying, just a minute, I made a deal with you guys and at least trying my best to work it out. However, it really didn't make much difference the outcome of the war or my career subsequently because I did it myself when I got back. Anyhow, arrived in Edmonton, in that end of that first week in November, and winter had just started. So we're sitting in West Coast clothing with no overcoats, and it was a little difficult for a week or two. They told us a shipment of greatcoats that had gone to India or somewhere that they weren't able to fit us all out, so I guess it was 2 weeks before I got a greatcoat. But even then, I sometimes wonder if it wasn't a marvelous job of organization to put a war together. We'd been in it for a couple of years by this time, and a handful of people that comprised the RCAF, and the Army I'm sure was the same as well as the Navy, that within 2 years had done such a tremendous expansion that the odd shipment of greatcoats to go astray has got to be very small in reality or in comparison. Anyhow, then also when you think of the number of airfields that were built throughout the prairies and here at Victoria, Comox and Port Hardy and Tofino. Port Hardy and Tofino, everything had to be barged in and no roads, but the airport needed to be in these places, and still they'd come up with all this wonderful development work. And now it takes them 4 years to just do a simple maintenance job. It boggles your mind sometimes. And to build a Navy, which was did an extraordinary job in the North Atlantic. Anyway, that's aside from it. This all sort of came swimming in on me. I realized what kind of an organization I was getting into. It's quite impressive.
Could I just ask you why you joined up? We discussed this the other day, but maybe it would be interesting. What were your feelings when you joined up? Why did you join up?
Oh, there was a mixed bag of feelings. Talk about patriotism. I definitely believed that what I was doing was the right thing in an effort to stop this Nazi fascist overwhelming of Europe, because the British Isles were threatened for certain. The if they fell, Lord knows where this thing might have gone. They had footholds in South America. It was not to be taken lightly. And they had got mittens on their belt buckle, and they all had padres, and so did we. And it made you wonder, maybe in under normal circumstances, had it not been for the genocide, and which was known to us even in those days, the concentration camps, because we'd been getting refugees over here since 1933, people who'd seen the handwriting, people that were, most of them Jews, few political people, but mostly Jews who were reasonably well fixed, could afford to skip the country and lose a house and still have enough left over to make a new start somewhere. These are the people that got out, the intellectuals, a few of them. The unfortunates, of course, are the little shopkeepers that no background at all, or not background, no wealth to escape. A lot of people didn't believe it, but by the time the war started, it was believed and it was known. And the subsequent material that has turned up at the end of the war was staggering. But looking back now, I can say certainly I would have done it again. Only I've got even more reason to believe in it now than I did then. Does that answer your question?
Sure. Yeah. No.
Okay.
That's good. That's
Right. Well, where was I?
Well, you'd arrived in Edmonton. It's about 20 degrees below, and you're freezing without greatcoats.
Yeah. Well, eventually we got our greatcoats, and I got posted to from the Manning Depot. That's where we learned how to march up and down and do slope arms and this kind of thing. And with air crew, what they would do is, at the beginning, was before you went on course, they'd send you off to some station for guard duty, where you did your 2 hours on, 4 hours off, just in a general patrol sort of a proposition, or to what they called tarmac duty. And if you're lucky, you got tarmac duty, because then you go to the hangar and you tarmac Adam, you know, the same old deal, but that was what they referred to it as. You messed around with airplanes, you towed them in and out of the buildings, and you were around what you really wanted to be around. So I got guard duty. It's still winter, too, and it was bitterly cold at Calgary. And then I went on course from there to number 2 wireless school in Calgary. And I wasn't very good at wireless. I get up to just 2 words a minute short of graduating and having difficulty, but eventually we got through that phase and went on to bombing and gunnery school at McDonald, and flying ferry battles. It's sort of like an English tank. Tremendous airplane. Didn't do much, but it'd go down, straight down, very, very fast. It was doing its best role, training. You couldn't, you know, they were just a sitting duck for a fighter in those days. They were like the Junkers 87, known as the Stuka. They were great for going straight down, dropping bombs. They had little whistles on them that just sounded terrible when they came down. You thought the banshees of hell were after you. And it demoralized people, for sure. But in straight and level, try to climb out of it, forget it. You know, they just drop like flies. Well, that's what happened to the ferry battle, and that's why they were in Canada. It was an obsolescent type. But, as I say, good old clunker. Anyway, I guess it'd be December. Just prior to Christmas, I got my embarkation leave. It'd be in 1942. And after Christmas at home, which was a neat way of doing it, I proceeded to Halifax. Missed my draft. Supposed to have gone out the day I arrived. All the rest of the fellows got there on time, but I... having to go from Vancouver to Halifax, it was 6 days and seven nights in those days in a train. And I missed the train. I got mixed up in... one of the towns, I think it was Toronto. Anyway, instead of going to Halifax, I went to Montreal. And, that was a little bit of straightening up to do. But so we arrived as the rest of the guy going into from the train station to the Y depot, which is an embarkation depot, in cattle trucks, going in. And there's all my mates had trained with hiking out. They were going for the train to New York to catch Queen Elizabeth. And... So I was another month in the Y Depot, and we left from Halifax on the Andes, which is a Royal Mail vessel, 25,000 tonner, fair-sized vessel.
Can I just thought of a couple of things I'd like to ask you about, which slightly take you back to the West Coast.
Sure.
I can't remember the date you said that you enlisted, but was it December?
November the 3rd, 41.
Okay, so it's before Pearl Harbor.
Yeah,
it wasn't anything to do with the Japanese attack that led
to
enlist.
No.
That hadn't happened yet. Okay.
No.
And the other thing was, when you enlisted, did you enlist with friends? Were there other sort of? Did you have friends who enlisted with you? So you went as a group.
No.
So the friends you were talking about, or your mates, were people you?
Well, those are the fellows I trained with subsequently.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh no, they weren't pre-war friends.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the fellows that I had grown up with were all in Seattle, where I had gone to school. And one of them got caught in the early draft before the Americans were in it, where I can remember the newsreels, they used a big lottery system. Everybody had a registration number, and they'd pick out three numbers at the end, like you do with your Lotto Canada. And there were about five or six of us used to chum around together pretty well. And one of the fellas, always a bad luck kid anyway, and he had his number drawn, so he was in it before I was. He got drafted in the spring of 41. And oddly enough, every one of us eventually got in it. Every one of us were right in the thick of it, and every one of us got back, which is most remarkable.
That must be defeating the statistics.
No, that's a flukeroo.
Yeah.
It's got to be. Well, I was a casualty. I was the only casualty in that I was shot down and taken prisoner eventually. But whereas they, one of the lads was wounded in the Battle of the Bulge, an American. But nothing we couldn't walk away from when the war ended, so.
Were there many Americans with the group who, with the group who sailed from Canada to Britain?
Few, very few. A lot of there were three American, four, no, there were more than that. There were about, I would say... In my group, and I don't know whether I'm talking about now 100 guys or 50, but I'm thinking then maybe in terms of 50, the fellows just around in my bunk space in the big barrack rooms, there was one from Missouri, Tex Rankin's son was in there, and another laddie from the States, both of whom already knew how to fly and thought that they knew all the answers, and eventually were sent back to the States because they were inclined to be a little bit orangutan-y. They were young and thought this is the way you're supposed to do it, you know. And I would say there were six in the bunch that I associated. So there were quite a few of them. And they started to thin out as, say, a year later, especially when they got overseas. Then they were given the opportunity, depending on their training, if they were adaptable to American standards. For example, a pilot's a pilot, but some of the trades couldn't be transferred quite that easily. So, but those who could, for the most part, eventually all wound up in the American forces before it was over. Some got shot down as Canadian airmen, and what they did after they got out, presumably they went back to their own people. especially if they joined up. I don't think any of them joined up prior to the Pearl Harbor thing anyway. There was no need to. But now we went across, took us 9 days in the roughest weather I've ever seen in my life, and I've been to sea subsequently. That was the worst winter, from what I've been led to believe, in recorded history in the North Atlantic. Force 10 and Force 11 and even Force 12. And I have since read stories of the submariners, the U-boat people, where in those days they had to surface in order to recharge their batteries. And when you're in a storm like that, how much is in the open air? It's just spindrift and heavy seas and people being swept over the side, even though they're chained or got steel cables to the deck to hold them with harnesses, like a parachute harness, and still they'd be swept away. So they had a harder time than we did. And being an ocean liner, a fast one, that with complete troop ship, couldn't afford to lose that. So never went in convoy, the big vessels. The we'd do maybe 20 knots, a convoy do 6. And we had our own pattern for evasive action and that sort of thing. Each vessel developed its own tricks.
And did anything happen on the way over? Did you...
No alarms, no nothing. No. Well, again, if a U-boat had spotted us, he would have had a great deal of difficulty getting in position, unless he just happened to catch us when he's about 2 miles ahead of us, directly in our path, knowing that we were doing a zigzag pattern. He might have got lucky, and he might have... Oh, the danger was there. But, again, I was too stupid to know it, fortunately. Saves my wear and tear on your nerves, I can tell you that.
So you weren't apprehensive, you weren't scared crossing the Atlantic?
No, I wasn't dumb. I wasn't bright enough to be frightened most of the time. Oh, I got scared a couple of times, but that's when you start learning about these things, is when you do get frightened. But at that stage, I thought I was fireproof. They told me I was anyway, so why should I worry? You know, we have absolutely perfect airplanes. Nothing can go wrong. You know,
So you're kind of protected by a naivete.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And they played on that. I mean, the people that trained us didn't, they knew what they were doing. They said, this is a parachute. When you put this on and you jump out of an airplane and you pull this thing here, it will open. You don't ever have to worry about that. Just try not to get in the position where you need it, but it's always there. Have faith. And they were right. So, there you are. Once in a while, I guess there was a mistake made, but anyway, they imbued us with a sense of confidence in our equipment. If we didn't have it, we'd have been, you know, you'd have been defeated before you got off the ground. Anyway, we didn't, I don't recall any of us being concerned about the U-boat, and maybe sort of knowing that it was so stormy that they'd have as much trouble as we would, but basically it goes down to the thing they said, this ship is invulnerable, it goes so fast no U-boat could ever catch it, so relax, and we did.
Was there any attempt to kind of pep you up politically? Was there any notion of kind
no,
of persuading that you were fighting a just war?
No. Everybody was motivated to start with, particularly in Canada. When you take Canada's total war effort, it absolutely staggers the imagination that of a 12 or 14 million people in this country, 10% of, no, 8% I think it came to, were under arms in uniform. Never mind the shipbuilders and the airplane builders and the all the rest of them. No, I think this is well documented, so I don't have to go into that. But no, Canadians were tremendously well motivated. There was an element, which I'll refer to only as an element. You could not be drafted into the Navy or the Air Force. You had to volunteer. But conscription came in, but because of the political pressure of certain groups, a conscript could not be sent overseas. But they wore the same khaki uniform as the rest of the soldiers, and there was a great deal of bitterness amongst those who did volunteer for Army regiments. And so it was devised that those who had volunteered had a general service badge, a little black badge with red letters GS on the sleeve, on the left sleeve, I think it was. And that was almost like putting a great big emblem on the back of the other guy. And the YMCA dances and stuff, the girls that used to go to dance with the fellows and that sort of thing, so you must dance with everybody, no favorites. But you can't legislate that sort of thing. And since they couldn't be posted overseas, they were posted the next best place, the Canadian Arctic. Weather stations, posted up there and forgotten. And it didn't bother us at all. We used to smile. But that was a small group. I never met any of them myself, I guess because I wasn't up in the Arctic. But overseas, of course, there weren't any. But we were well represented as far as Bomber Command was concerned. For a country our size of population compared to that of Britain, that we were able to man a complete bomber group. And to say nothing of the attrition, as well as augmenting the personnel in fighter groups and coastal command. I'm just speaking of Air Force now. And to say nothing of the ground crews that were spread all over the place, and also Canadian crews in the Far East, which, and of course the attrition in Bomber Command was a bit of a loser. I didn't realize it at the time, or I might have made another decision, but it was, reading it after the war is a little bit frightening. That I've forgotten the percentages now, but they weren't very nice. And I remember one thing, this is just on this point, but jumping ahead slightly. I arrived in Dulag Luft, and I was talking to another RAF fellow there, but from Bomber Command. And I said, you know, there's only about 10 of us here, and there are about 90 or 100 Americans. I said, they must be having awful bad luck. And he said, no, they're not having as bad luck as we are, but he said, they're all flying in daylight. And he said, we're just not getting away with it as easily because, right away, of course, the light came on because being in darkness and you're staggering around inside a cluttered up aircraft, you can't find your way around. And I mean, it's black. And you go to grab a piece of equipment, it's not there anymore. It just happened to have been blown away or whatever. And so that the number of people that were actually escaping from their aircraft under these circumstances was much higher in daylight. But it took something like that to point it out to me. Anyway, so I arrived in Scotland finally after a very interesting trip. There wasn't a stick of furniture on that ship, wasn't broken. It was incredible.
Were you allowed booze on board?
No, I don't think so. I didn't drink in those days anyway. Oh, hey, I got to tell you one thing, though. The victualling on that ship was, well, astonishing. I can't. They victualled the ship in England, where they, being an English vessel, instead of when they're going back and forth anyway, and they had all the chances of doing it the other way around. I guess this is where stuff-shirtedness or some darn thing entered into it. But we had, without a doubt, the worst food that I'd experienced in my life up until that time. There were other instances, not all of them in Germany, too, I might add. But we'd go down. We got two meals a day, and we walked down below into a mess hall attached to the galley, and there were these fabricated long tables, like two legs or an X at each end, and big boards in the center, and they might seat 20 guys, as I recall. So everybody go down there at a given time. There were about three sittings, And two guys from each table would go up to the galley and draw a ladle of tea, or a pot of tea, a big one, and a big container of maybe 2 gallons of macaroni. And I'm talking about the kind that slithers around with no, there's no tomato sauce on this. Don't worry about that. And bread, and the bread was sour. It was, I don't know how they made it do this, but it was just virtually inedible. There was no margarine or anything like that. And or sometimes you get a thick pea soup, like peas pudding. And if you don't think we had the constipation problem on that ship, we did. Anyhow, the deck was a sort of a quarter of an inch or half an inch of goo, and that you couldn't scrape off with a putty knife. And the next was sort of mucky. And then on top of that was yesterday's and this morning's spilled spaghetti, tea, everything else. And I've seen guys try to make it from table to table because this ship is a-going. It's up and down and sideways. And they change course every 15 minutes. That means you're not pitching now. You're rolling the rails under. And this would happen at any time, and you never knew if you weren't holding on to something. Off you go, just sort of spinning down the aisle. But I've seen guys go feet out from under, land on flat in their back with these two pails. Okay, when you finish, you got your Army issue mess kit, you know, a little square tin pan that fitted into another one and the swell stuff. And when you finished, then you had the opportunity to go and wash these. And there was a tub about as big around as a big laundry tub. And it was cold, and there was grease floating on the top of it from everybody else's. And you put it in there, and you say, do I want my own trench mouth or somebody else's? But the officers, in spite of that, had tablecloths and crystal and silver, which didn't do a lot for us. There was a discrepancy here, especially in air crew, where you train with a fella, and X number of them got commissions, and the difference was so marked and severe that it caused a bit of a strain in the Canadian, in the RCAF. Until near the end of the war, they weren't asked whether they wanted commissions. They were forced to take commissions if you were aircrew. But there was a lot of friction because of fellows, a pilot being a sergeant and his wireless operator being commissioned, or a gunner. The whole thing was a mess. On the ground, he was a sergeant. In the air, he was a captain. And then you get these problems where some officer crew member goes off and gets himself all Elephant's Trunk and Mozart down at the local pub and causes a ruckus and disgraces the uniform and all those swell things. And then this sergeant pilot is called up, why don't you look after your crew? And yet he's not allowed in the same bar. You know, this sort of thing. Well, that eventually got sorted out. But this discrepancy was most noticeable on the ship when we got over there. Arrived at Garrick, up the Clyde, and it seems we had about an hour just to wander around until we formed up on the railway siding for our trip south. And I can remember another fellow and I wandered into a candy store. Oh, you should have seen all these swell, delightful things. But the gal, I guess she knew what we were thinking, and she said, you have to have ration cards. And I thought, oh, we're over there, you know. No wonder they had so much swell stuff in the window. Nobody had any cards. Anyhow, we took a train down to Bournemouth, sat up the whole way in the English version of an American day coach. It was a completely open carriage. You didn't see too many of them over there. But anyhow, we arrived in Bournemouth the next day, and then it was a question of being assigned to commandeered luxury hotels, which had been scooped clean of furniture, and all that was in any of them was a cot, in maybe 5 cots to a room, and which was normal. We didn't mind that. And we'd form up for parades every morning and get marched to this place or that place and do something to keep us busy. It was all it was. There were no courses. Oh, correction. We did go down and shoot skeet for a while on the beach. That is, just gunners. It was good training. I don't know that it made any difference. But I enjoyed skeet shooting. And later on at the squadron, I was going around with a girl who whose folks ran a bit of a farm, and there was always lots of good grub going when you live on a farm. But a friend of mine, he was in with a family that didn't have these options, and we used to go and shoot skeet. And in Canada, we used a little 22 that was just for practice, but in England, they gave us real shotguns as shotgun shells, and they weren't too careful about rationing them. They'd give you, here's 10, blow them off, and we'd be three or four of us in together, and they didn't count the total shots, so we might rattle off maybe five, and we got five shells for one of the civvies. We'd go and bag a rabbit or two, and that always helped.
What were relations with civilians like?
Oh, good. We never had any problem anywhere I was. They were always considerate. Canadians always seem to have a fairly good name. Fairly low profile politically, I suppose, would be part of this. In Holland and Belgium, of course, Holland in particular, because the Canadians did so much, they were right in the front lines during the liberation of Holland, that they've got lots of friends up there. And even in Belgium, where I was during the occupation, the people there told me that they'd always had first-class relationships with the Canadian troops in the First World War. So, no, that was good. I never ran into any problems.
Was this the first time you'd been overseas?
Yeah, I'd never been to Europe prior to the war.
What were your impressions when you arrived in Britain and Scotland?
They weren't all that much different than what I expected, because my dad was an old school tie, dyed-in-the-wool Englishman anyway, and thought that the rest of the world was, well, just a little substandard. But, oh no, he'd told me so many stories about the places that he'd lived and grown up and this sort of thing that and worked. He was 30 when he came out to Canada, so I wasn't surprised by what I saw at all. I couldn't get used to blackouts and things like that, but and it was incredibly dirty. And I put this down to the fact that the war and fires everywhere and this sort of thing, especially in the big cities, that it wasn't until I went back in 1960 to see some of the work they'd done to clean up, and the rest, some of those old buildings are still the same. And I began to realize then that's the way it was in the big cities. I was back last summer, and I find that they've made tremendous strides in urban beautification. Some of the places that were just terrible before are really nice places. They've done a lot of sandblasting, cleaning up the old stone faces of the building, that sort of thing. But of course, when we first went over, we arrived in Bournemouth. Now, Bournemouth was the garden spot, the resort spot, that and Brighton and a few other, Torquay and the hotels. And they had the big pavilion that was like a civic auditorium almost. They had a concert hall, they had restaurants and all sorts of, well, in a big park right in the heart of the town. Well, I was given a ticket to a symphony. Just us standing in front of the place, and the little old lady came up and said, "You're not doing anything, my boy. How would you like to see the symphony?" I said, "Thank you very much. Here's a ticket." I went in. I've forgotten the name. Basil. Forgotten his name. Anyway, he was conducting. Marvelous experience in that beautiful big pavilion. So that we weren't getting a true introduction to what the terraced housing of Manchester was like. So, but England is a very complex place. You can't soak it all up in wartime in 2 weeks. Anyhow, after a period of about a whole month, I would say, maybe a little less. Oh, yeah, it'd have to be less, maybe a couple of weeks. I was posted to a refresher gunnery course at Stormy Down in Wales. And Stormy was a nice place. It was within walking distance of the seaside town of Porthcawl, halfway between Swansea and Bridgend on the railway line to Fishguard. And the weather there was brilliantly clear and bitterly cold that winter. And I remember going down, walking on the seaside at Porthcawl, beautiful place, just stunningly beautiful, the sand dunes and the whole thing. But the RAF camp at Stormy was the worst military camp I'd ever been in before or since. And I include some German establishments in that. The sergeant's mess was protected ground. And as trainees, we'd only been sergeants a short time. We weren't familiar with military protocol and the way of doing things within the established routines, and that really we had every right to go into the permanent sergeant's mess, but we didn't even have a mess. We didn't have anywhere to go. The mess hall we ate in was about the size of a large old farm kitchen, if you can picture it. And they had deal tables, these collapsible military tables that are used from everything from mess halls to training facilities and all. There are millions of them in existence. I wonder what ever happened to them all. Must have burned them. Anyhow, these things ran from one end of the room to the other with no gaps. And benches, there were about, as I recall, there were two rows of these. There might have been three, but I think there were two. And they went from one wall to the other with no gaps and benches. The only way you could get there was to walk over the table. Now, this is supposed to be a civilized place. The standard fare, sausage and mash, or beans on toast. Same thing you got in all the British restaurants, which British restaurants, that's in quotes. It's a restaurant, a nationalized thing that was started up during the war. I don't know if they still exist. I doubt it very much. Just to feed transients who didn't have ration cards, and you didn't get very much. Lots of tea. British Rail tea. Hasn't changed, incidentally. But this is what we got. And you got it in a sloppy plate that we didn't have to wash. That was the only thing we didn't have to do, is wash the plate. I don't think they did it either. But imagine having to climb over two tables with some fellow trying to have his meal. Well, that was an incredibly bad place. And they had a little tiny stove in the middle of the barracks block, which is a Nissen hut. And there'd be row beds down each side of the hut, feet to the center. And I guess maybe 20 guys in each hut, something like that. And a little tiny cast iron stove in the middle with a straight cast iron pipe for a chimney, which was designed to get the heat out of the building as quickly as possible along with the smoke. Oh, yeah. For somebody who can build the most sophisticated airplanes in the world, it can't overcome this traditional business of being cold. But it didn't really matter because it didn't give us any coal. We used to sleep in our flying suits. Fortunately, this course lasted 2 weeks. Seemed like 2 months.
Did you have any spare time, much spare time?
Oh, enough.
What did you do in your spare time?
Hiked down to Porthcawl. I think I went in there maybe two or three times in the time I was there. Went to the pub one time, movies the other time, and hiked around. But it must have been a Sunday or something because we were down there all day one day. And anyhow, oh, yeah, my laundry had been left at, when I was shipped out, the laundry had been turned in at Bournemouth, and I never did get it until I had been on the squadron. And I went to Porthcawl, I went up to the conversion unit and down to the squadron, and it finally arrived. I had more clothes than anybody else because they had to reissue me. It just was what I stood in. So I had a complete RAF issue, complete RCAF issue. And then I got shot down. I guess somebody else had a whole lot of swell uniforms. Yeah. Anyway, from there we went to Yorkshire to be converted onto
at a conversion unit where the twin-engine crews were being converted to new types. Of course, everybody hoped we'd be on Lancs, but it turned out we were on Halifaxes, which was a splendid airplane and did almost everything the Lank would do except carry as much and go quite as fast. It wouldn't go as fast. And the Lank was the prestige machine. And you rarely hear of Halifaxes, let alone Stirlings in this day and age, but in those days, of course, they were all mentioned equally. It was just a question of there was a little more charisma about the Lancaster, and justly so. It did turn out to be the finest bomber outside of possibly the Americans' B-29 of the whole war. The 17 was a good airplane in the American side, but they didn't have the bomb-carrying capacity to make themselves as effective as they might have been. But that's another side of it. Anyway, we got onto a Halifax conversion unit, and that's where I got crewed up with an ex-Whitley crew, and there were two of us to be added. I was assigned to this crew as a mid-upper gunner. It was an RAF squadron, RAF group, four group. Six group, which is a Canadian group, had been formed by that time, but we're still talking in terms of attrition. And they just formed them up with whoever they had at the time, which would be preponderance of RAF, and then they started, as soon as they could get this thing established, why, they started feeding Canadians into it until by the time, early 44, I guess, it would have been pretty well entirely Canadian. And we used to hear stories about get peanut butter up there. Yeah, funny little things like that that stick in your mind. And I was a bit of a peanut butter nut. I still like the stuff. But I could go to Boots, the chemists, and they sold peanut butter, believe it or not. It was a little green, maybe a different kind of peanut, but it was sure good stuff. A little bit of home. Peanut butter sandwiches and Cokes. Enough Americans amongst us, or enough North American influence for us to like Coca-Cola. I even found it in Brussels during the occupation, Coca-Cola. Nobody over there drank it. Didn't know what it was for the most part. Anyhow, I crewed up with my bunch at Rickle, a little town near Selby, halfway between Leeds and York. And we did continued training on four engine on the Halifax. And